You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot in the news. I want to introduce you to some of the radical Republicans who are going to be running the show in the House next year. This is important stuff to know. BP, we talked about the corporate death penalty last week. I think somebody at the Obama administration was listening. Real interesting news there. Actually, there's a lot going on. But one of the things that I find most fascinating is, having lived in Georgia for over a decade, I 10, 11, 12 years, something like that, maybe even 13 years. I'm not sure how long we lived there, but I'd have to go back and add it all up. But it was quite a while. And we lived in Marietta for about half that time and lived up in Roswell. These are both northern suburbs of Atlanta. And I remember when Louise and I and our kids were living there in Georgia. This was back during the 1980s, in fact, pretty much throughout the most of that decade. Max Cleland was our senator. Max Cleland. Max Cleland, who in 1968, Vietnam War was going full tilt boogie. Max Cleland was an officer in the U.S. Army. He was a battalion signal officer. And he was on a hilltop in Vietnam setting up an antenna, brought in and taken out by helicopter. And as he and two other soldiers were getting out of the helicopter, a grenade fell out of it. Max Cleland reaches for the grenade. He's going to grab this thing and throw it out of the way, or you know, get it out of harm's way before it gets them. And it goes off just as he reaches for it. It took off his arm and both his legs. Max Cleland, the guy who was my senator for most of the time, maybe all the time I lived in Georgia, was, you know, one of those genuine war heroes. You could hate the war, but, you know, there was no doubting that Max Cleland gave as much as anybody could. I mean, he left two legs and an arm on the battlefield or on a mountaintop in Vietnam. So the Republicans decide to run against him. They run this guy named Saxby Chambliss, who had no military experience. The guy wimped out during Vietnam, and I didn't go to Vietnam either. But Saxby Chambliss was not the war hero that Max Cleland was. But in the election of 2002, Saxby Chambliss. Now, keep in mind, this was a year after 9/11, a year and 2 months after 9/11. Saxby Chambliss runs a TV ad that starts out with a picture of Osama bin Laden, and then goes into, you know, this rant about how Max Cleland had voted against George W. Bush's efforts to keep us safe. Words to that effect. This was one of the sleaziest campaigns probably in my lifetime, at least at the level of the Senate. I mean, here is Saxby Chambliss, this Republican weasel, calling Max Cleland unpatriotic, saying that he's basically, you know, not willing to stand up for his country, that he's ignoring the needs of his country. Well, the actual phrase is that he was soft on security. Right. Because Max Cleland, according to Chambliss in this TV ad, voted against the Department of Homeland Security. Now, that's a whole nother rant, where the word homeland came from and the stupidity of, you know, but, you know, we'll save that. Turns out what Cleland actually voted against was a provision that would have stripped away the collective bargaining rights of the employees of the Department of Homeland Security. But in any case, you know, Chambliss runs this ad. The polls leading up to the election all showed Max Cleland beating Saxby Chambliss by 6 to 7 points. This was the first election in the history of the state of Georgia to use 100% paper-free touchscreen machines. A patch was applied to them just a day or two before the election that was supposed to fix a calendar problem. And somehow that 6 to 7 point lead that Max Cleland had turned into a 140,000 vote victory for Saxby Chambliss. Now, many of us think the vote got flipped, but whatever the case may be, whether the vote was, whether Saxby Chambliss stole that election or it was stolen on his behalf, because the same kind of flip happened in the gubernatorial race. The Democrat was way ahead. The Republican ended up winning the race. And this was in the pre-election, day of election, and post-election polls. In all of them, they showed Max Cleland and the Democrat running for governor ahead, and then they, according to the Diebold machines, lost. So now Saxby Chambliss has to look out because he's got a crazy guy coming after him. Saxby Chambliss has been in the Senate now, what, about 10 years? And in 2 years, he's up for re-election. And Eric Erickson, this crazy guy from, you know, Red State and CNN, well, I shouldn't characterize him as crazy. I'll let him characterize himself. Here's Eric Erickson talking about the Augusta, you know, the Masters, the golf tournament. Here he is.
I don't really care. And I don't care that.
Hang on just a second. Let me reset that. Let's start over again. This is him talking about how the Masters won't let women play. Now, play it again.
I don't really care. And I don't care that the Masters is a male-dominated event. I don't care that women aren't members of the Masters. Frankly, I kind of like the idea that women aren't members of the Masters. Good Lord, I don't want to go hang out at some women's event. Can't men go anywhere and just be men?
So Saxby Chambliss has a guy coming after him who just likes to hang out with men, you know. Clip number two. This is Eric Erickson saying that Obama supports infanticide. I mean, this is how bizarre it gets. Killing babies. Infanticide means killing babies after they're born. But you could, however you want to parse it. Here he is in all of his.
We don't actually want our kids to be killed. I mean, you, Mr. President, you were okay with kids being born, even though there was supposed to be an abortion, and then killing them after they were born. Infanticide is what we used to call that. Now we call it post-birth abortion, apparently.
Yeah, right. Eric Erickson asking if Obama's going to crusade to stop women from shaving their armpits.
Do we really want to be France? Because that apparently seems to be the goal of the Obama administration. What's next? Are they going to come out on a crusade against shaving your pits if you're a woman?
Eric Erickson on hippie protesters, in other words, Occupy people, getting tasered.
You can watch it. I won't play it on the radio because of the number of F-bombs the guy just starts yelling as they're tasing him. but watching a hippie protester get tased just makes my day.
All right, this guy now is going to probably, he says he's prayerfully considering it. Talk show host, author, CNN regular, whatnot, Eric Erickson is going to probably primary Saxby Chambliss. And my message to Saxby Chambliss, it's karma, buddy. It's payback time. You know, live by the sword, die by the sword. Well, not die, but, you know, politically anyway. If it's like, He went after Max Cleland and called him unpatriotic, and now he's going to, I guarantee you, Eric Erickson's going to be saying the same thing about Saxby Chambliss if he decides to run against him in a primary.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Karma is tough. We'll be back. Indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, this is concerning. Obama flexible on high interest rates. Yeah, the Associated Press is reporting that the White House is saying that, well, you know, it doesn't have to go all the way up to 39.6% like it was during the Clinton era on rich people. Let me tell you, there is a scam going on here. And that is that what is being promoted, what, you know, and what the Republicans are fighting about so loudly is this, you know, raising the top tax rate, the top marginal tax rate on earned income from 36 to 39.6% or 35 to 39.6%. And, you know, yeah, it'll generate a little bit of money. It'll generate around $80 billion over the next decade. Not a tremendous amount, because it's mostly going to hit people who are making $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year. That's pretty much it. Anybody who's making over, and that's mostly your really well-paid executives and your really well-paid, you know, genuine high-skilled professionals, your surgeons, literally your brain surgeons, your rocket scientists, your some entrepreneurs, I suppose, but most will figure out a way to get their income via capital gains. And that's the point. Is anybody making over $500,000 a year? Probably anybody making over $300,000 or $400,000 a year isn't taking their money as pay. They're taking their money as dividends or as interest. Or they're playing the game that a lot of rich people do, play, is they're putting their money into some kind of a trust or keeping it in the company or whatever, and then they're borrowing an equivalent amount of money and paying 1.5-2% interest. To the company even. And so, you know, they're getting enormous amounts of money basically tax free because it's borrowed. And then at some point they'll take it as a dividend. The bottom line here is that genuinely rich people in America, people with really, you know, genuinely high incomes, are not going to be affected by this, you know, rolling back the Reagan tax cuts, rolling back the Bush tax cuts to the Clinton era. And even if we rolled them back to the Reagan era, 74%, it wouldn't affect it. What we need to do is we need to roll back not only the Bush tax cuts and the Reagan tax cuts on high income earners, but we also need to, at the very least, go back to the Reagan era tax rates on capital gains and dividends. The reason Mitt Romney pays under 15% income tax is because we have a separate category of income taxes for genuinely, really, incredibly, mind-bogglingly rich people. And their top tax rate is 15%, period. That's the most Paris Hilton and Mitt Romney are ever going to pay. It's called capital gains or carried interest loophole, if you want to call it the rate. So the real discussion that we should be having, and oddly enough, Joe Scarborough was writing about this morning and on Politico. He's quoting Steve Rattner. He says, you know, we need $1.2 trillion, not, you know, a couple tens of billions of dollars. And we'd get that if we actually raised the capital gains tax rate. That would actually inflict some pain. And if we had a minimum 30% income tax on anybody earning over $1 million, which is what Warren Buffett is out there promoting, regardless of how you earn your money, capital gains or whatever it may be, 30%, period. Now, under Reagan, the capital gains rate was as high as 28%. I think it should go to whatever the earned income tax rate is. You know, the surgeon who pays 39.6%, why is he or she paying 39.6% and the bankster is paying 15%? Mitt Romney's paying 15%. This makes no sense to me. If anything, it should be the other way around. If you're going to give preferential tax treatment to somebody because you think what they do is so important to society, give the 15% tax rate to the surgeon. But the fact of the matter is we can't afford a 15% tax rate on really rich people and really high income earners. So as Joe Scarborough, of all people, former Republican congressman, says, if politicians really want to make millionaires and billionaires pay at the tax rate that most of us endure on April 15, and Joe is saying this because even though he makes millions of dollars a year at MSNBC, it's considered payroll. So he's paying 36% income tax. I guarantee you, he's not an owner of NBC. He's an employee. So he says, if politicians really want to make millionaires and billionaires pay at a tax rate that most of us endure on April 15th, Their moral pangs would be soothed more effectively by following Buffett's minimum tax plan or focusing on raising the tax rates on capital gains and carried interest. Yes, sir. Never thought I would agree with Joe Scarborough, but he is totally right. And that conversation is the conversation we should be having in America right now. Why is it that banksters, why is it that there's a dozen people on Wall Street who last year took over $2 billion each in income, called a carried interest, and paid a maximum 15% income tax rate on it? When people who are doing real work are paying up to 36%, and soon will be paying up to 39%. Why is it that those banksters are paying 15%? Why is it that the Mitt Romneys of the world pay a maximum 15%? It makes no sense. That's the conversation we should be having. And nobody's talking about that at all. And it's like the media is just buying into this. They're going, oh, yeah, you know, oh, geez, fiscal cliff, tax rate. Yeah, we're going to go back to the Clinton tax rate and capital gains. Actually, capital gains rate will go from 15 to 20%. Big whoop. I mean, this is a really important issue. And nobody wants to touch it. Why? Well, I'm guessing because the people who actually own most of the media, see, the owners, they take their pay in capital gains and dividends. Now, you can't do that. I own a small business. I can't do that. IRS won't let me. I don't have enough stockholders to declare a dividend. So I can't play this game that Mitt Romney plays. It's bizarre, isn't it, when you think about it? I mean, not that I make that much anyway, but it is bizarre.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's like we've got a tax rate of 15% just for fat cats and Paris Hilton. Period. Needs to be done away with. By the way, the second hour of the program today, we're going to get into how the FCC may be about to hand America's media over to Rupert Murdoch. This is bizarre. And in the third hour of the program, Anna Marie Cox is going to drop by, founding editor of the political blog Wonkette and the Washington correspondent for GQ. She's got a new piece in The Guardian about Grover Norquist, and we'll get into it. Did you hear that at the White House today? I mean, just ended just an hour or two ago. Mitt Romney came over for lunch. They had Southwestern chicken salad and chili for lunch. And apparently no alcohol was served and no caffeine. And, well, maybe the president had a cup of coffee, but the Mitster didn't. And reportedly, now this is according to inside sources, not the official sources, not the reporters, but, you know, like the butlers or the Secret Service. We're not really sure where the story came from, but from buried deep inside the White House, that Mitt Romney was offered the job of ambassador to the Cayman Islands so he can keep an eye on his money. Yeah. Okay. I'm guessing I'm not the first one to have made that observation. In fact, probably Stephanie Miller beat me to it by hours. Anyhow, John in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. You know, I understand Tim Geithner is negotiating with the Senate Democrats for the White House.
Yeah, that's a good news, bad news story. The bad news, of course, is where you're going, which is that it's Tim Geithner, who's basically, you know, Robert Rubin reincarnated. The good news is that they're doing a divide and conquer strategy. He's not negotiating with them as a group. He's doing it one at a time.
Right. I'd rather Bernie Sanders was leading the negotiations.
There you go. And Bernie will be with us for an hour tomorrow. I absolutely agree. And, very, very well said, John. Thank you very much for the call. Don in Pittsburgh, Kansas. Hey, Don, what's up?
Oh, hi. Well, I just wanted to mention that, it's more of a long-term situation, but a financial transaction tax, a Tobin tax.
Right.
We pay, anywhere from 6 to 10% sales tax on anything we buy, usually in many places, even services. Mm-hmm. And yet these guys transfer millions of dollars. They're running computer trades, millions of trades a second sometimes, and they pay no tax.
Right.
This is trillions and trillions of dollars.
Right.
They've hollowed out some skyscrapers in Midtown Manhattan because they're enough closer to the main phone switch that they get a millionth of a second quicker and filling them with computers. I mean, these are parasites, these people.
They absolutely are. No, and, you know, we had this tax. It was called the Security Transaction Excise Tax, STET tax, the STET tax. And this was first put into place in 1935 by Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he created the Securities and Exchange Commission and hired Joe Kennedy, telling Joe famously, it takes a crook to catch a crook, so I want to put you in charge. Hiring Joe Kennedy to run the Securities and Exchange Commission. And, of course, when you create a government agency, unless you're a Republican, you pay for it. And so FDR, to pay for the cost of the SEC, he put this tax, I think it was a tenth of 1%, on every stock trade, on every stock transaction, the security transaction excise tax. And that STET tax stood until 1964. And in 1964, that STET tax was producing hundreds of millions of dollars more than it cost to run the Securities and Exchange Commission. So a bunch of Republicans and some blue dog Democrats got the brilliant idea, hey, we got a tax here that's generating a lot more money than it needs to. Well, and they were all, you know, being heavily financed by Wall Street. So let's just do away with it. So in 64, we did away with the STET tax. And as you point out correctly, Wall Street has gone crazy since then, and we need to bring it back. We need to pour a little bit of sand into the gears, slow the machine down a little bit so that these parasites who are doing this program trading with these computers, and they're just sitting back making literally hundreds of millions or billions of dollars a year. A couple of the guys who made $2 billion a year last year on Wall Street did so simply by owning a computer next door to the New York Stock Exchange, as you correctly point out, Don. And it's wrong. It's
well,
just,
you know, also that one of the problems with it, of course, is that they'll just claim they'll run away to London thing. But there's an increasing movement in Europe towards, you know, people are talking about a financial transaction.
Several countries have actually already imposed them. Germany has imposed it, I believe. It may not be Germany because there's the DAX. They're talking about it in the UK, but you know they're scared that the FTSE is the, you know, they got a big stock exchange there.
But
I'd have to go back and look. We did the story here 5-6 months ago. There were several countries that have put on, that have already instituted STET taxes. They don't want this stuff going on in their countries. And there was a thank you for the call, Don. That and the story of, like, for example, Iceland. These are like the untold stories. We had, what, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, we had a guy on from Iceland who was, or am I remembering our TV show, one or the other, but we've talked about it here constantly. And, of course, we did our show from Iceland a few months ago for a couple of days where we interviewed politicians and whatnot. We have been covering the fact that in Iceland, when the worldwide collapse happened, Iceland was actually hit harder than pretty much any other country in the world. Because the banksters had just run amok. Iceland had totally bought into this. They had this conservative government for a while. And they totally bought into this whole Milton Friedman, you know, neoliberalism, super conservative, libertarian nonsense, and deregulated their banks. And so they were the most heavily leveraged country in Europe. And they had this huge real estate bubble going on. And all of their banks failed. Everything failed. I mean, it just boom. And what did the Icelanders do? They threw a bankster in jail. They nationalized their banks. They said to the stockholders, sorry, you guys were engaged in a criminal enterprise. You're out of luck. You're SOL. You're on your own, buddy. And then they crowdsourced a constitution that would address these issues. They're in the process of doing that right now. I mean, there's a lot of stories like this that need to be told. It's really important. David in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, David, what's up? You want to talk about rocket scientists?
5770.
David?
Okay, I'll call you right back.
Okay. David, can you hear me now? I really wanted to get David on because, I guess he hung up the wrong phone. Okay, he's vanished. Because David said that he's a rocket scientist. I was talking about rocket scientists earlier. Okay, what happened? Dean in Littleton, Colorado, listening on AM 760. You wanted to talk about capital gains?
Yeah, Tom, I wanted to know your ideas. What if we decided to treat capital, basically get rid of capital gains, treat it like income,
right,
and alternatively drop the corporate tax rate to 0%?
Why would you want to do that? Corporations are using our commons. Why shouldn't they pay for it?
Well, I'm not saying they shouldn't pay for it, but alternatively, you want businesses to grow and flourish. I mean, the side I feel like I haven't heard you talk about much is what capital gains do to investments and businesses.
They do very little. When Reagan had the capital gains tax at 28% and the ordinary income tax rate at 28%, they were identical for a year, 1986. They were identical, and it didn't change anything.
And I feel like this is the fundamental disagreement.
And then the other point, you say the corporate tax. During the Eisenhower administration, the corporations were accounted for about a third of the total revenues of the federal government. Right now, they account for less than 10%. You've got not only super wealthy individuals not paying taxes, and the Forbes 100 richest people, a quarter of them are paying under 15%, and six of them are paying nothing in taxes, even though all of them have incomes of over $200 million a year. But in addition to that, you've got corporations that used to pay a third of the federal income, the third of the cost of running our federal commons. You got giant corporations that are using our military to protect their interests. You've got companies like Microsoft that wouldn't be able to exist if you didn't have the Department of Trade running all around the world enforcing copyright and patent laws. All these giant corporations, General Electric, another big one, copyright and patent laws, making their money on that, Disney, others. And what are they paying in federal taxes? Well, General Electric, nothing. What's wrong with this picture here, Dean?
Well, my issue is what I hear coming from conservatives is this whole double taxation idea,
It's nonsense.
What's nonsense about it? I mean, I'm really trying to learn because,
okay.
I mean, is it just on principle that they believe this?
My little company, at the end of the year, my little company pays taxes on any profit it has, and it pays my salary and Jacob's salary, or excuse me, and Shano's salary and Jim's salary and Danielle. And so we've paid, that money's been taxed, and then we pay it out as pay. Should it not be taxed? And then when it goes out as pay, they take it down to the local store and they buy something, or I take it to the local store and I buy something. It gets taxed again, sales tax. Then the store takes that money and they pay their employees. It's get taxed again. I mean, every time transactions happen in an economy, there's a tax laid on them. So why should we say, out of all those, hundreds of thousands of times that a dollar gets circulated, and every time it moves from person to person, or company to person, there's some sort of taxation on it, with the one single exception of Paris Hilton, of people who live on the dividend income, that we should call that double taxation? That's nonsense. This is a canard. It's a device, a lie, functionally, that very, very wealthy billionaires, Frank Luntz came up with for these guys, this whole double taxation. Here's a frame that you guys could use to justify paying a very little or even no income tax on the income that you have. Why should somebody who makes their money by investing money pay any lower tax rate than somebody who makes their money by working? There's no rationality to it. And this whole double taxation thing, like I said, it's nonsense.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's like I should say, okay, I don't have to pay sales tax. I already paid income tax when I took this money. What? You think a store is going to say, oh, fine. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, let me just fact check myself with myself. Back in September of 2008, I wrote an article for Common Dreams titled How Wall Street Can Bail Itself Out Without Destroying the Dollar, and I actually did my homework and researched this thing, and I was just a minute ago running off the top of my head, and Shano Googled stat tax, and my article popped up as a top thing. Securities Turnover Excise Tax, first of all, is what it's called. Secondly, the first time it was put into place in the United States was during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln. Then it was put into place during the Spanish-American War. That would be the McKinley administration. And then we put it back into place in 1914, as we were heading toward World War One, presumably. And it stood from 1914 to 1966. I said 64. And what FDR did is he doubled it to pay for the SEC in 1935. So, and with regard to other countries, right now in the UK, there is a stat tax. It's 0.25%. If we did that in the United States right now, it would produce $150 billion a year in revenue. Now, in 2008, when I wrote this article, I was saying that the banks can, Wall Street can bail itself out with the stat tax. This was when Bush was bailing out the banks. Remember the two TARPs and the stimulus, all during the Bush administration, that all the Republicans voted for, that they're all going to now say, oh, we can't do that, right? So, and then other countries that have stat taxes, the UK, France, Japan, Germany, Italy, Greece, Australia, France, China, there's two Frances in there, China, Chile, Malaysia, India, Austria, and Belgium. So, yeah, let's get a stat tax. Odell in Buffalo. Hey, Odell, welcome to the program. Religious right, Wall Street?
Give me 80 seconds, and I'm going to surprise you. Here we go. All right. The other day you were talking about the beast. Okay, in Revelation it says that the beast. All right. It says you can't buy or sell unless you got the mark of the beast on you. The mark is on the forehead or in the hand.
Yeah.
Okay, the Lord says those who got this.
Actually, the Bible doesn't say hand, it says forehead. But, yeah,
this is what I call Ash Wednesday. Now, the other thing I got here, wake up.
Okay, okay.
The Republican Party no longer exists. It is an organization.
The Republican Party, Odell, let me, respectfully, the Republican Party has not existed as a political party since the 1880s. It has been the front group for the railroads, and at that time, the biggest corporations in America, and the oil companies and the steel companies, and now, for any, the banksters and everybody else. So thank you for the call. Richard in Evanston, Illinois, listening to WCPTA. Richard, what's up?
Hello. A couple of things. When the fellow just mentioned double taxation with corporations, and are there aspects also? I used to work for three big corporations in America. One of them's getting $50 million next year to maybe hire 500 people. I worked at another one that had jobs in Puerto Rico, and I remember a number from a long time ago that they would get a tax break of $175,000, I think, or maybe it was $75,000. I can't remember at the time.
Yeah. The pharmaceutical company's got a special carve-out to get a tax break if they manufactured in Puerto Rico, which is why the pharmaceuticals
are
big down
there. I mean, it's just huge. You could give everybody, I remember laughing, a couple of Mercedes-Benzes for each of these low-paying jobs that they had there. But the other thing that the other thing was tariffs. No one talks about tariffs, and
I do.
It's kind of amazing. I know. I mean, but
all the time. It's me and Ross Perot. I mean, that's here we are.
Yeah. Well, and his running mate is a great guy too. It turns out, Choate or whatever his name is, an interesting book. But Korea, sends 77,000 cars a few years back, and we send them 500.
Right.
There was a recent article in Forbes, Brazil. Charges $86,000 for a Bronco.
If you want to buy a Chevy SUV in China, it'll cost you around $50,000 because of their import tariffs.
They tariff our products, I believe, at 25% roughly.
Yeah.
I think it probably varies to some extent, but we tariff theirs 2.5%.
Yes.
And we're the only country that's just opened up our economy and our jobs.
I know we went stupid.
We're being robbed.
Yeah, absolutely. And what the other countries of the world did to get, when everybody said, okay, let's do this free trade thing, let's all get, it's like somebody, at a party where people have been smoking too much pot, and somebody says, hey, let's all get naked, and everybody starts taking their clothes off. Flashback to the 60s. But it's like we did that, right? It's like all these countries in the world, the neoliberals, the Milton Friedmans of the world say, hey, let's all take off our excise tariffs. Let's all get rid of our protections, our national boundaries, and let's trade nakedly with each other. Well, all the rest of the countries of the world said, sounds like a great idea. And then in the background, they said, let's create this thing called a value-added tax, where we tax everything at every stage of production a small amount, and then for our exports, we can do away with the value-added tax, which will actually discount our exports. And for anything that gets imported, from a country that doesn't have a value-added tax, we're going to hit the, you know, we can appropriately hit them with a value-added tax at the border, which works as a tariff. So if you try to import a U.S. car into Germany, you're going to pay 15, 16, 18% equivalent of a VAT tax. On the other hand, if you want to import a car from Germany to the United States, they will discount it by that much. Why we don't do this? Well, I think the reason why we don't do this, Richard, is because the big corporations, these giant transnational corporations, we still are, probably will be for another year or two, the world's number one consumer market. And so it was like, hey, you know, let's just bleed these guys dry. Let's just bleed the American middle class dry. And that's what they're doing.
I work for, Tom, I work for a company that imports a lot of stuff from China, and they have a holding company that's offshore. And you kind of say to yourself, too, what in the world is that about?
It's about avoiding taxes.
How much they're marking. Yes, I mean, how much they're marking stuff up, too, to pretend that it costs more to get. So when we talk about taxes and the deficit, there are other sources as well to try to get in more revenue.
Listen, tariffs, Rich, we're out of time, but I want to get this in before this hour ends. Tariffs paid for 100% of the cost of the federal government from the George Washington administration to the Abraham Lincoln administration. They paid for two-thirds of the total cost of the federal government. This is import tariffs from the George Washington administration to World War I. And they paid for fully a third of the cost of federal government from World War I to World War II. Tariffs were a significant source of income right up to the Reagan administration, and then it began to really collapse. Richard, thank you for the call. We need to go back to import tariffs. With you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, Rupert Murdoch, he ain't happy with just basically owning much, if not most, of the media in the United Kingdom and Australia, several media holdings in the United States, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, Fox News, Fox Television. Which of the movie companies does he own? It's all there. 20th Century Fox, that's right, all that stuff. It's like, he wants more. He wants a media monopoly. He's currently jockeying to buy the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, which just so happened to be the nation's, or not the nation's, but the largest newspaper in the nation's second and third largest cities. So, if he gets these, they would add to his current media empire in the United States, which includes the most watched cable news network in the nation, Fox so-called News, the most circulated newspaper in the nation, the Wall Street Journal. And the only things standing in Murdoch's way of full-spectrum media domination in America are FCC rules, Federal Communications Commission rules, that forbid one company from owning both a newspaper and a television station in one town. Murdoch already owns local TV stations in both Chicago and Los Angeles. But according to sources inside the FCC, the chairman of the FCC, Democratic Obama appointee Chairman Julius Genachowski, is quietly planning to scrap these rules that go back to the 20s. Under pressure from major media moguls like Murdoch, who see big bucks, and by the way, huge political power in a consolidated national and local media. Genachowski circulated a new order to other FCC commissioners, which is apparently how it got leaked out to us, that would allow for cross-ownership of TV and newspapers in the nation's 20 largest media markets. They tried this during the Bush administration, 2007. FCC tried this. Got shot down when the Senate voted to repeal it. And then a federal court blocked it. Not to mention the fact that, the FCC has this open comments period. 99% of the public comments that the FCC received opposed that media consolidation effort. But that didn't stop Murdoch or the other media moguls. They kept going, pushing, lobbying, buying off. I mean, who knows? Maybe Genachowski's been offered, made an offer he can't refuse. I kind of doubt he woke up with a horse's head in his bed. It's probably more like, hey, how'd you like to have a job at News Corp for, say, $1 million a year when you retire from the FCC. You know, let's not talk about it now, but, you know, after you retire, give me a shout. So now we understand President Obama's FCC is going to consider these rule changes again next month, as in, like, next week starts next month in December. And if you and I, if Americans don't get involved in this issue, if we don't push the FCC to say no, if we don't call the White House comment line and say no, if we don't go to freepress.net and participate in their campaign to say no to this, then Murdoch and his billionaire buddies are going to get what they want, which is complete domination of our news media. I mean, this is how bad it is already. Ben Bagdikian points out in his book, The New Media Monopoly, the United States is already basically the victim of a complete media monopoly. Today, only five corporations, one of which is Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, own the majority of all the media seen, read, or listened to by Americans, radio, TV, newspapers, and magazines. Hundreds of newspapers, thousands of radio stations, hundreds of television stations, tens of thousands of magazines, the majority of them owned by five companies. If the FCC gets completely out of the way, it's going to get even worse. More consolidation, more monopoly. And this, not only does this produce, you know, not only is monopoly like bad for economies, which is, you know, enough reason to oppose it. It stops innovation. It keeps, you know, small players out of the marketplace, prevents new people from coming into the marketplace. Or if they do, they only last, you know, a year or two before they get bought up by one of the giants and then homogenized. I mean, this is you say, well, you know, there's still people starting new businesses and small businesses. And yeah, but the new business plan is start a business and build it up as fast as you can so that you can sell it to one of these big guys before they squash you like a bug. Okay, so there's that economic problem. It's bad for our economy. It's also a huge problem for democracy. And if there's one monopoly that's more dangerous than all the others, it's a media monopoly. Having a democratic republic, you know what we're supposed to have, a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. If you want to have one that functions, as Thomas Jefferson so eloquently and repeatedly pointed out, you have to have a well-informed electorate. Voters who are well-informed. And if one corporation or one eccentric billionaire owns the means of information, they can hijack the public debate and bend it to their will. For example, consider what happened in Italy. You know, for years we did Berlusconi alerts on this program. Remember Silvio Berlusconi? He started out as a cruise boat lounge singer and small-time hustler. Then he bought a newspaper, then a small television station, then a radio station, then another TV station, then another newspaper, then another radio station. Then he bought another TV station, then another newspaper, then a radio network, then a TV network. And suddenly Berlusconi ended up owning about 95% of all the media seen, heard, or read in the country of Italy. And with the control of the information in Italy, Berlusconi decided to run for prime minister. And wouldn't you know, he won. Surprise! In fact, you know, with this iron grip that he had on the media, Berlusconi served as prime minister of Italy for three full terms, or three separate terms, totaling nearly a decade, despite the fact that he was accused, and I'm not talking about by his detractors, I'm talking about by prosecutors, was accused of nearly every crime you can imagine, including tax fraud, false accounting, corruption, bribery, perjury, mafia collusion, aiding terrorist organizations, and having sex with minors at his infamous Bunga Bunga parties. I mean, that's how crucial a media monopoly is to political power and legal immunity from prosecution. In the meantime, Berlusconi oversaw the downgrade of Italy's press freedoms, as documented by the organization Freedom House, which demoted Italy's press. Italy, we're talking, you know, a fully developed modern European country. They demoted Italy's press from free, like the rest of Europe and the developed world, to only partly free. Main reason for the demotion? Berlusconi's ability to completely manipulate the media, which, according to Freedom House, was a conflict of interest among the most blatant in the world. It took the technocrats of the European Union to force him out of office last year. Ultimately, if the FCC approves these rule changes and allows Murdoch to gobble up more and more of our media, then we could be facing our own Silvio Berlusconi situation. Not that Murdoch is going to run for office, but instead, he's a kingmaker in the Republican Party. Already is. And he puts prominent Republicans on his payroll. Sarah Palin, Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, John Kasich. If he's got a bigger media empire, maybe even a monopoly, he's going to be able to handpick politicians and then use his massive conservative media complex to win elections Silvio Berlusconi style. And that should scare the hell out of all of us. And it should scare the hell out of President Obama, the guy who is the boss of the FCC. But apparently we can't depend on Obama to act on this, so we have to do it ourselves. Get over to freepress.net and join the campaign against Murdoch's media power grab. This is serious stuff. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We talked about the corporate death penalty last week. I got to give you an update on that. I think the White House is listening to the show. We also talked about the NDAA. You know, broken clocks are right twice a day. So is Rand Paul, apparently.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'll tell you all about that right after the break. So, and Gitmo might be on the table. Stick around.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud.
Oh, it's our geeky science. Just two quick minutes here. I can share with you my favorite science story of the week. Being a total science junkie, the Center for the Study of Existential Risk, CSER. It's based out of Cambridge, a European research group. They are concerned about what happens. Well, actually, the headline, the BBC, this is the BBC. BBC News. The headline says the whole thing. Risk of robot uprising wiping out human race to be studied. Here's the thing. We know how many billions or trillions, I don't know, I don't have the number here, but we know how many interconnections there are in the human brain, how complex the human brain is. And it's the incredible complexity of our brain, you know, beyond the complexity of lesser, shall we say, animals, that provides us with self-awareness. Not to say that animals don't have self-awareness, but the unique kind of self-awareness that we have. So the question is, as the World Wide Web grows and the number of interconnections grows and begins to approach the number of interconnections, the number of raw interconnections, unconstrained, unrestrained interconnections that we have in the human brain, when we have a number of computers out there equal to the number of neurons we have and synapses, actually, a neuron can have a bunch of synapses, the interconnected points. Will the World Wide Web become sentient? Will it wake up and say, I am? And if it does, will it say, I am? And what are these humans doing? So they've decided to study this. Professor Price told the AFP, Agence France-Presse News Agency, it seems a reasonable prediction that sometime in this or the next century, intelligence will escape from the constraints of biology. The seriousness of these risks is difficult to assess, but that in itself seems a cause for concern, given how much is at stake. Fascinating. So they're looking at this stuff, seriously looking at this stuff. Okay, other things. I mentioned a broken clock is right twice a day, as the old cliche goes. And occasionally Rand Paul gets it right. Yesterday on the floor of the Senate, Rand Paul, you know, the National Defense Authorization Act is being debated. Now, there's a reason for that. Excuse me. The Constitution explicitly says, Article 1, Section 8, Article 1 is about Congress, first among equals, the first of the three branches of government. Section 8 is the powers given to Congress. And, of course, the power to tax and the power to spend are first sentence for two purposes. Provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare. Okay, got that. But when it comes to the common defense, the founders were very wary about the military. They were not concerned that, you know, hey, somebody might create a Social Security program. Well, in fact, you know, George Washington signed legislation to provide for poorhouses here in Washington, D.C., to give housing and medical care and food to people, to the poor. Started with the Washington administration. There was no time limit on it. It wasn't in the Constitution that, hey, you know, if you're going to give money to poor people, you can't do it for more than 2 years because we need to reexamine that regularly and make sure that we're not doing something stupid. No. We've been doing that since the founding of the Republic. We're still operating now under some of the rules that were put in place by LBJ, some that were put in place by Franklin Roosevelt, some that were put in place by Teddy Roosevelt, some that were put in place by Abraham Lincoln. Land-grant colleges still around. But there was one thing that the founders said, you, Congress, and they said it in the Constitution, you, Congress, may not appropriate money for more than 2 years, period. Every 2 years, you have to start again at zero. And that one thing is the military. Here it is, Article 1, Section 8, Sentence 12. Okay. Article 1 starts out, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Sentence 12, to raise and support armies. But no, now this but doesn't appear anywhere else in the Constitution except with regard to armies. To raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a term, for a longer term than 2 years. Now, the next one is to provide and maintain a Navy. You don't have to reappropriate the Navy because they figured, okay, you know, we're always going to need a Navy to protect our borders. But an Army, they did not want to have an Army during times of peace. So you cannot run the military budget for more than 2 years without Congress having to reappropriate it, which is the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. It's the appropriation for the military. And the last time it came up, last year, right around this time of year, this indefinite detention provision was put in that said basically the military can arrest you if they think that you're consorting with terrorists and keep you in prison forever without a trial, which is on its face unconstitutional. So Rand Paul on the floor of the Senate yesterday said, let's strip that out. He proposed an amendment that would take that out, him and Mark Udall and Kristen Gillibrand. And he said, if we give up our right, have not the terrorists won? If we relinquish our rights because of fear, what is it exactly that we're fighting for? Rand Paul is right. So the Gillibrand, Udall, Paul amendment, call your senators and tell them to vote for that thing. Amend the NDAA.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Enough of this. We don't like you. We're going to put you in prison forever. No, you don't get to see a judge. No, you don't even get to know what you're charged with stuff. It's wrong.
When I'm feeling all teary and I want to give a greeting because I'm in the holiday mood. And I know it's scrambling in my brain. Trying to guess what they celebrate. And I give it all up and a couple
of... Welcome back to the True People's Meeting, the Tom Hartman Program, 34 minutes past the hour... Amazing. Okay, NDAA, I told you about that. The corporate death penalty, we went off in this rant a week or two ago when ExxonMobil pled guilty to the largest crime, or the largest, you know, agreed to pay the largest criminal penalty anyway, in the history of the United States, maybe in the history of the world, $4.5 billion, for causing more than $40 billion worth of damage. Now, that's not a bad equation from BP's point of view. Yeah, we'll will cost $40 and $50 billion worth of damage, and we'll pay $4.5 billion in fines. Yeah, it's a cool, no problem. And I was on the air saying we need to bring back the corporate death penalty. Off with their heads, metaphorically. Pull their corporate charter. Well, you know, the Obama administration has almost done that. They, you know, today they announced that they're barring, this was front page last night in the Financial Times is where I saw this. The Environmental Protection Agency announced it is barring BP from receiving any new federal government projects or contracts because the foreign corporations, quote, lack of business integrity, end quote. And not only is the EPA doing this, also the Department of Interior is saying no more drilling on public lands. You can't, basically you can't do anything more than you're already doing until you prove to us that you can operate in a honest and functional fashion. I think it is marvelous. It's like one of the probably most underreported stories of the day. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number, Rick in Grass Valley, California. Hey, Rick, what's up? What's on your mind? You want to talk about capital gains?
Yeah, hi, Tom. We seem to have this myth kind of along the lines of the job creators that once the capital gains tax, if you raise it, it's somehow going to have an impact on the companies that initially issued the stock. But once the stock's been issued and sold that first time, it just becomes a form of gambling. It has nothing to do with the company itself.
That's
and the
right.
company's not going to benefit from anything that happens to the
yeah,
stock.
Yeah, let me clarify this for people who don't know what you're talking about. If I went out and bought $1,000 worth of Apple stock, most Americans who don't invest or who don't understand how the stock market works think that somehow I'm giving $1,000 to Apple. Not true. Apple doesn't see a penny of that. I'm buying that $1,000 worth of stock from some Apple shareholder who wants to sell $1,000 worth of stock. And we do it on the stock exchange, and some broker, some middleman, some, you know, whatever, you know, the one of these companies, the E-Trade or something, you know, they skim a little fee off the top like we should be with the stat tax, and, you know, for facilitating that trade. The only time a company makes money on the sale of stock is when they do an initial public offering or when they have subsequent offerings of, you know, expansions of their stock, when they sell off more of their company. That's it. And so you're absolutely right. So and when companies issue dividends, that goes out to the stockholders, but it's not going to, you know, if it encourages or discourages people from buying the stock, it's meaningless to anybody except the stockholders. The problem is, and this is, there's a great book on this called The Myth of Shareholder Value. The problem is that during the Reagan administration, prior to the Reagan administration, the tax laws made it virtually impossible for you to compensate senior executives and CEOs with stock. And they flipped that upside down on the theory that if they own stock, they would represent the interests of the stockholders. And so now a CEO might take a $2 million salary and then take $70 million worth of stock every year. And that way they can convert that stock after a year, call it a long-term capital gains, pay a maximum 15% income tax on it, and, you know, live fat and happy. And the theory is that because they're a major stockholder in the company, or, you know, minor relative to the company, but major in terms of their own investment portfolio, that they will then behave in the best interest of the stockholders. Well, what they do is they don't behave in the best interest of the company, which is what they're hired to do, a CEO, and they don't behave in the best interest of the employees, which is what they should do if they're reasonable, you know, responsible human beings. And they don't behave in the best interest of the customers, which you would hope that they would do. Instead, they behave in the best interest of the gamblers, the speculators. Back to you, Rick.
And then the other aspect is... Well, now I've just lost my train of thought. But
okay.
Anyway, yeah, go ahead.
I think you got it. And you know, you got me off on this thing. And this is the whole reason why capital gains, it's irrelevant what the capital gains tax is. It's not going to affect the health of corporate America. It only affects the bottom line of the millionaires and billionaires who basically, and thank you for the call, Rick, who basically make their money on capital gains. And yes, I know, you know, in fact, this morning I was listening to NPR and there was this, they did a piece, and it might not have been NPR, it might have been one of the, you know, PRI or whatever that provides programming to them, but it was a piece on the capital gains tax, and they had this little old lady on it going, I don't, you know, might get some dividends from my Walmart stock, and I'm concerned that the taxes are going to go up on it. Well, sorry, you know, they're not, I shouldn't say sorry. Let me reassure you. Little old lady, if the dividend top dividend tax rate went from 15% to 91%? Unless you're making more than $70,000 a year if you're married, you're not going to pay more than 15% anyway. And, you know, if you're paying, if you're making, you know, less than $25,000 a year in dividend income, you're not going to pay anything in capital gains taxes. So come on, get a grip. Sandy, in Conroe, Texas, you believe that Obama needs to fight for the middle class in a second term?
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom. Thank you for all of your years of staying true and your staff. Yes, I think that Barack Obama, President Barack Obama, whom I supported, and I had a man in 2008 try to strangle me when I voiced that I was going to vote for this man, mm-hmm. whom stayed virtually quiet for the first 4 years. I understand how politics are, and I truly believe that he is in a position at this time where he could make such a remarkable difference, mm-hmm. even if the laws that need to be changed passed. He can use his voice to make a difference.
Yeah, he has the bully pulpit. And this is, and he has an incredible machine, as it were, to reach the people that he mobilized to vote for him for specific issues.
Well, Clinton.
The danger is if he uses it too often, you know, if I get too many emails from, I got one today from President Obama, right? And it was about, you know, support this thing to raise the taxes on rich people. And if he does that too often, people will start putting it in the spam folder. And so he's got to be very, very careful about not overexposing himself. But you're absolutely right. He has the bully pulpit. He needs to be using it. He needs to be using it on behalf of the American middle class. And my personal take on all of this, you know, whether it's Julius Genachowski at the FCC or anything else, it all has to do with money and politics. We need to go back to laws that say, you know, close the revolving door. Genachowski can't get a job in the media when he leaves the FCC. Sorry, can't do that. We need to say that the billionaires who are funding political campaigns can't do that anymore. Go back to the $2,100 per person limit on political contributions. I mean, there's just simple stuff. And the problem is the Supreme Court. This is why we need to amend the Constitution to say corporations are not people and money is not speech. And that's movetoamend.org. And I wish the president would pick that up as a crusade. Sandy, I got to move along, but thank you for your call. You're so spot on. Excellent point. Bob in Marseilles?
Marseilles. Yeah, nobody here speaks French.
Of course. Same when I lived in Montpelier, Vermont. People would come by and go, oh, Montpelier! And we go,
Yeah, exactly. The question I had was the Telecommunications Act. Wasn't that originally, was it 1932 or 34?
I don't remember. I thought it was in the 20s, but it may well have been in the
30s. No, I believe it was in the 30s, but it's back far enough that Marconi and Tesla were probably still alive.
Certainly Marconi
was. In any event,
yeah.
The changes that were made to it, I believe Clinton approved a big one in 97, I think.
1996.
Yeah. When was the other one, under Reagan?
I don't know.
Because we got sold down the river a couple times.
Oh, the big change that Reagan made was in 87 when he stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine, which was
in any event
a doctrine, not a law.
We should take it back to I think we should take it all the way back to 1934. It definitely it isn't working at all right now the way it should work.
I think we need to say that if you want to own a newspaper, a radio station, a television station, you know, any of these major media outlets that should be local, that you have to live in the community in which that exists. And,
exactly.
You know, which is basically how it was back in the day. And
if you look at the numbers now on how many people own TV stations and radio stations, and you look at the numbers in 1960,
yeah.
It's not a fivefold; it's a hundredfold. It's
a really big
situation.
And the really great stations are like, you know, you're listening to WCPT, which is owned by you know a fellow in Chicago. It's owned by a local guy in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, St. Paul. We're on a station that is owned by, you know, a local person, a local family. This is how it should be. Our WWRL, our station in New York, I believe is owned by at least a relatively small corporation. So this is how it should be in this country, and not just in radio, but right across the board, particularly newspapers. Newspapers really need to be responsive to the communities, but you know, radio, television, right? You know, but no, we're not going to have that conversation in this country for quite some time. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, the GAO just came out and said that if we close Gitmo, no problem. We can do it. Somebody tell the Republicans. Tell them to stop obstructing the Democrats.
Every time I read the news, I'm always more confused.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check out the news. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition to free Don at free-don.org. And our news source, of course, the brilliant Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service.
I don't know about that, Tom.
TalkRadioNews.com. Hey, Ellen,
but
what's going on?
It's interesting. Yesterday, this was at Bradley Manning's Article 13 hearing, the psychiatrist who was a captain, he's a military captain, Captain Kevin Moore, testified that his pre-trial confinement at Quantico Brig were worse than any other long-term pre-trial prisoner he's ever observed. He tried to go above to the colonel, and he was turned down. So when you have a military psychiatrist testifying that this was an inhuman kind of condition, it really is quite astounding. And he said that he was the angriest he had been in a long time when the Quantico base commander...
He being the psychiatrist, not Bradley Manning.
When the Quantico base commander stated in a meeting that nothing's going to change, he won't be able to hurt himself, he's not going to be able to get away, and our way of ensuring this is that he will remain on this status indefinitely.
Wow.
Now,
I understand,
America, folks.
Yeah, and in fact, the NDAA is being redebated, and Rand Paul, you know, a broken clock is right twice a day.
Right.
Rand Paul.
Well, I got another one of these broken clocks for you.
Okay, great. Go for it.
So Dan Burton, remember he used to shoot pumpkins in his backyard, Dan Burton?
The Republican from California?
Yeah, I think he's from Indiana.
Indiana, okay. Yeah, you're right.
Was testifying before Daryl Issa's committee today, another stellar character.
Yes, and former small-time crook.
Yeah. And they were talking about the autism spectrum diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan Burton got up and testified. He used to run the committee and say, you know, listen, everybody thinks I'm against vaccines. I'm not against vaccines. I'm against mercury in vaccines.
Right.
And that if there were single vials for vaccine, there would not need to be mercury, et cetera. He said he thinks that we're getting too many problems with autism spectrum disorder, too many cases of Alzheimer's, because he believes that is related. And then Dennis Kucinich got up and supported Dan Burton, strange bedfellows, and also talked about his concern about coal and mercury, and that people are breathing in this coal, and that is why people are also getting sick.
Right, because it's very bioavailable mercury, the stuff that is in coal, because it's been processed by vegetation 100 million years ago, or whatever.
That's right.
And that's why there's no mercury safe seafood anymore in the United States. I mean, it comes out of our lakes
and
rivers.
And you know, my doctor takes my mercury level, and that's why I've cut back on seafood. I just won't eat most seafood because it's bad.
Yeah, which shouldn't be. It's just
right.
Yeah.
Okay. The president did meet with Governor Romney today. They had lunch together.
Did he offer him the ambassadorship to the Cayman Islands?
No, he did not. But I'm sure there was something going on there. They had, I hate to say it because you know I'm a pet turkey, white turkey chili, grilled chicken.
Oh,
they said that they would stay in touch if there were opportunities to work together, which means not a whole lot.
Did the president offer him a cup of coffee with a chuckle?
No. I don't think that happened. Now, it's interesting. The defense authorization bill has come through the Senate today. They would like to strike the ability to send anybody out of Gitmo. It's in the Senate language. There's going to be an amendment to that. The White House is very unhappy about that. They actually sent out like a four-page thing that I have in my hands.
Wow.
That are complaining about.
So let me get this right. The new National Defense Authorization has in it language that says we can empty Gitmo.
No.
And the Republicans want to amend it to say, no, you can't.
It is already in there that you cannot send anybody away from Gitmo.
Oh.
Despite the fact that Dianne Feinstein came up with something, there was actually a GAO report that basically said there are many prisons in the United States that are very capable of taking Gitmo. Gitmo could be closed.
Now, this,
it is
this
in
originated,
the Senate language.
If this originated in the Senate, it originated in a committee that was Feinstein's committee?
I don't know because it's the defense authorization has many committees. It's
right.
Not just one.
Right, yeah. It includes intelligence and the Army and all this other stuff.
And they went through this about what the administration is not happy campers.
Yeah, they want to close Gitmo.
Well, they want to close Gitmo, and they would like to have, you know, Bush would have just made a signing statement and done what he wanted.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe Obama will.
They'll try to impeach him. Would be my guess. Not going to succeed, but that's what
they're
going
to try to impeach him anyway, Ellen. You see all these phony outrage things. You know, now it's Susan Rice and Benghazi and, you know, Daryl Issa. He wants to be the who was the guy who impeached Nixon? Anyway, he wants to be the Senator Sam
right.
Sam whatever his name is. He wants to be him.
Right.
So anyway, we'll see.
Exactly. Okay. The Democrats, Senator, I'm sorry, Speaker Boehner said the Democrats are taking a victory lap instead of working on the fiscal cliff. But what are the Republicans doing? That's my overall question on that front.
Yeah. Now, Boehner did say to a news reporter today that who said, what specific cuts do you want in social programs? And Boehner says, we've already passed the budget. So Boehner's basically saying we want to voucherize Medicare. Why is that not being reported? I mean,
I think it's not being reported because, in some respects, people have felt like Boehner is just saying the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
I mean, he has
so
said
it's not
that.
His.
That isn't whatever. Huh. Okay, there are a couple other pieces of news. The Federal Trade Commission sent warning letters to 22 hotel operators. They will not list those who they are, but they're basically saying you quote a rate on the internet and then you do all these extras. So it's not really the rate that you're quoting.
Uh-huh.
So that's one. They are also, this is a fascinating one, the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission said a restaurant was made to offer the same meal deal. A lot of people, if they brought in a church bulletin, were getting a 10% discount. They said they have to offer atheists the exact same deal because you cannot discriminate on religion.
Well, that's interesting. A business can't discriminate on religion?
No.
Huh. That's going to be challenged.
Of course, that will be challenged. That's right. But it's a public accommodations law.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I see. Okay.
Right.
So it's the law. There you go. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, free-don. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
So thanks so much for being with us. We will be back with Anna Marie Cox.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations all across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and 200 cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. Glad to have you with us. For this third hour of our program, Anna Marie Cox on the line with us, writing for
Hello.
The Guardian. Anna Marie, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here.
It's great to have you with us. You're writing about the fiscal cliff. This is like, you know, being portrayed like it's something. You use the metaphor of Star Wars in here. What the image that immediately came to my mind the first time I heard the phrase fiscal cliff was Thelma and Louise, flying off the cliff at the end of the movie there. And this furry Rumpelstiltskin, Grover Norquist? Please tell me where what do you think is going on here?
Well, yes, I called Grover Norquist the furry little lobbyist, the Rumpelstiltskin of the Potomac. And it's that particular sort of part of it is the part of it that's kind of mysterious to me. Grover is not elected to anything. You know, his group isn't that big. The tax pledge didn't come out of any mass movement. He's just sort of had this weird sway over people. And I don't know how that's happened, but it's true that we are seeing that grip starting to loosen a little bit. Although ironically, I think that's probably because of the rise of the super PAC in the post-Citizen United era. Grover just isn't the biggest, you know, he's not the biggest bear in the woods anymore.
Well, in the last reporting cycle, which I guess was a couple of years ago, showed that the Koch brothers through one of their foundations had channeled $4 million that year to Grover. Could it be that now they don't need him anymore, now that post-Citizens United, they can just buy their own politicians?
Yeah, I actually think that's sort of what's happening. And I think that, you know, Grover, I think before Citizens United, he had this very specific niche at the tax pledge. And I think now that money is sort of, you know, unlimited and can go anywhere, places like Americans, Crossroads, GPS are going to be the places that really sort of get that kind of money. But, you know, we are seeing an interesting thing happen. We're seeing Republicans have to explain themselves and have to sort of account to why they would even sign this pledge, which I think on its face doesn't make a lot of sense to an average person. And in fact, I'm not sure an average person even knows this pledge exists.
I think this pledge makes people into traitors, essentially. At least members of Congress, they have to swear an oath that it's called the true oath or the ironclad oath or whatever
right.
It is that started in I had all these information and statistics last week when I did a whole rant on it. Now I'm trying to do this from memory, but it was the late 19th century. The Constitution requires an oath, and it used to be just a very simple sentence. Now it's a couple of sentences, and one of them is that that as a member of Congress, you are swearing that you are coming into office without having made prior commitments, basically. I don't remember the exact language. And it seems to me like this is a violation of their oath of office.
Well, at least it's one we can point to as a formal violation. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people come into office with previous commitments that we don't know about.
Yeah.
But this is one that actually people make public. And again, I guess you must have explained, and your listeners must know, that this is a pledge not to raise taxes pretty much under any circumstance. You know, no matter like what the good of the country may be, it is a philosophical, almost religious kind of belief, not a statement of political economics. You know, not something that people have come to believe through study. You know,
yeah.
It is just an article of faith that's what you should do, and it really, I think, prevents people from considering what's in front of them. And that is what you want in a lawmaker. You know, you don't want a lawmaker that's going to have one thing that they know and that they decide all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Back to you.
I'm just saying, you want a lawmaker that considers each situation.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's responsible to constituents, yes. And if you represent a conservative district, you know, I'm sure that you have constituents that want you not to vote for raising taxes, but I'm sure they also want you to think about each individual instance, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so the modern oath, this was passed in 1884 by Congress. It superseded one that Abraham Lincoln had put into place in 1862, which basically made you swear that you weren't a member of the Confederacy, that you'd never committed a crime against the country. By 1884, they wanted to, you know, kind of re-embrace the former Confederates. And so the modern oath says, and this is the oath that every single member of Congress swears, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear the true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
Yeah.
Now, how does that not contradict having sworn fealty to Grover Norquist?
Well, yeah, I mean, when you think about it, there's actually, you know, I believe there was also a pledged commitment to preserving the sanctity of marriage that went around, you know, this year. I mean, all these pledges are nonsensical in terms of politics.
Yes.
And again, it sort of speaks to the very basest way that we think about politics. One of the things that is sort of in the piece of mind that you're talking about that I think is interesting, if we look at this election, I think that people are ready for more complicated discussions with their representatives and more complicated arguments.
Yeah.
The Obama campaign had a sort of a second order of sophistication into their argument to get reelected. You know, they couldn't just be like, elect me. They had to present a case that responded to criticisms, which is much more difficult than simply saying, like, other guy sucks.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I think that, you know, we elected a guy with a more complicated argument. Maybe we're ready to sort of elect people that don't just say no, 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 no matter what.
And yet it looks like the Republicans are getting ready to do to literally double down on this. I mean, you write in your article we're talking with Anna Marie Cox and her about her new article in The Guardian. Guardian.co.uk, of course, the website. The mm-hmm. title of the article, Fiscal Cliff Hype and the Future of Grover Norquist's Taxpayer Pledge. You draw a parallel to the Star Wars trilogies and Taxmageddon. You know, everyone has to have a bigger explosion. I mean, is it
right.
conceivable? The last time that the Republicans did this, that they drove us to the edge of a cliff, Standard & Poor's downgraded us or Moody's, whichever one, I think it was an S&P, yeah, downgraded us and said that they did so because the Republicans were playing games with the budget.
Yeah, and I'm of course you know that. I mean, it was one of the more frustrating things to follow some of that conversation and hear that people thought we were being downgraded because we were mismanaging our money, and the real reason we were downgraded is because we were mismanaging our political discussion.
Yeah.
You know, we were mismanaging our politics.
Well, not even we. A very small number of people in the Republican Party were.
Right. And the good news, as you know, is that the fiscal cliff is really not that much of a cliff.
No, it's a fiscal bungee cord.
It's a fiscal, I've also, my favorite saying is it's a fiscal fjord.
Fjord. Okay.
And I think that you know, one theory that I've heard is that Boehner is just trying to keep it together until the new Congress comes in, which is going to be less vehemently Tea Party, and that maybe he can use there's sort of a cushion period between, you know, January 2nd and when some of the taxes and cuts actually kick in.
Right, yeah. But don't you think that Eric Cantor is still going to be standing behind him with a shiv, just, you know, poking him in the kidney?
I do. And it's just going to be a question of whether or not, you know, Boehner can – what Boehner sees when he looks out, you know, his window to America. Mm-hmm. You know, if he sees the same America that Cantor sees, and he sees, like, the rise of the Tea Party, and he sees the Tea Party as the only animating force that really has any, well, animating life in it, left in it, in the Republican sort of party when among conservatives, then he probably will. I mean, isn't it hard to sort of figure out, like, what are they actually going to do if this all goes haywire? Like,
we live in interesting times, my friend. I mean, this is going to be a fascinating couple of weeks. You've so nailed it. Anna Marie Cox, you can read her work over at guardian.co.uk. Thank you, Anna Marie.
All right, thank you.
Great talking with you. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day, my thoughts, your comments, your calls, and all that kind of stuff.
You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down the line, this is a union town.
Not many of those left, at least not in the United States. I mean, in the other developed countries of the world, of course! In New York City, and this is just, you know, it's like, okay, last week it was Walmart workers in several cities around the United States and over 100 locations, actually, around the United States. Walmart workers walked out or sicked out and, you know, in protest of the high cost of low wages. Today, it started with the McDonald's at 6 a.m. in Manhattan. McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, Domino's, Taco Bell. People are going on strike. Their ultimate goal is to raise their pay up to $15 an hour. The average age. Now, the Republicans say, oh, you know, these are entry-level jobs. You know, of course they should pay $7.50 or $8 or $9 an hour. They should pay very little because teenagers take these jobs. This is how you enter into the job force. Why do you want to keep people out of the job? The average age of a person working in the fast food industry is 28. This is not an entry-level job. At 28, a lot of people have families. They're trying to buy a home. They're trying to, and you can't do it on $10 an hour. Or $7, $8 an hour. So they're asking for just $15 an hour. And the average daily salary of CEOs in the fast food industry, daily salary. And this doesn't include all the stock options and all that other stuff that we were talking about earlier with the capital gains. The average daily salary of the CEOs in the fast food industry is $25,000 a day. Can you imagine? Look at your checking account. Hey, another 25,000 bucks went in. Tomorrow, another 25,000 bucks went in. Day after, another 25,000. Daily pay for CEOs in the fast food industry is $25,000 a year, and these people are having to go on strike to get $15 an hour. Not 25,000 a year, 25,000 a day, excuse me. The CEOs are making, and the employees are just asking for 15 bucks an hour. It's insane. 14 of the 17 employees at the McDonald's at Madison Avenue and 40th Street walked out at 6:30 this morning. So those of you listening to us on WWRL in New York or Sirius or however you may, you know, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, if you're in New York City, you might want to get down there to the McDonald's on Madison Avenue and 40th Street and tip your hat to the workers. But there's others, you know, hey, what do you say? We demand fair pay. It's what they stood outside the restaurant chanting this. Raymond Lopez, 21, and an aspiring actor who's worked at McDonald's for over 2 years, told the New York Times, we don't get paid for what we do. It really is living in poverty. This is wage slavery. It's one of the slogans of the American Revolution, of the abolitionist and labor movement, all the way up into the 1850s and 1860s, was no chattel slavery, which is old-fashioned own-a-person slavery, and no wage slavery. It's time to revisit that. It's amazing that we have wage slaves in the United States. It goes beyond amazing. It is an absolute moral failing of our country to have this kind of a situation. We're, you know, the richest nation on earth, and we can't pay our workers enough that they can have a decent life. And yet the CEOs are making $25,000 a day. Carl in Polson, Montana. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hello, this is Carl. How are you doing?
I am very well, thank you. You wanted to talk about corporate taxes and limited liability?
Well, yeah, you had that fellow on before that was curious about why corporations had to pay taxes, but corporations get a huge break because they have limited liability. So if the corporation goes bankrupt, they're only responsible in terms of their assets as to the amount of stock that they own. Whereas if you, like when I owned a partnership, was part of a partnership, everything that I had was vulnerable to the asset collection on whatever debts that company had accrued.
You're right.
And we never cure that. People sit there and say, well, is this double taxation? It's not double taxation. We have two situations in Montana, one in Libby and one around Anaconda and Butte, that are the largest toxic waste dumps in America, and who is going to pay for those after those people, that those companies went bankrupt or were sold to another corporation and they pledge all sorts of immunity from those liabilities? Who's going to pay for that? The public, the people in America, right, are going to pay for that. Right. And they are, and if we don't charge them some kind of a tax on their income, we're stuck with the whole bill. At least we've got a little bit in the bank to take care of those kinds of liabilities that occur from those actions.
Yeah. And it's a real tragedy. My old co-host in the morning show on KPOJ, Heidi Tauber, who has now passed on herself, as a result of a car accident. But Heidi's parents, she grew up in Libby, Montana, and her parents died of exposure to asbestos. Her dad
your
was
own father died of.
I'm sorry?
Your own father died of mesothelioma, didn't he?
That's correct, yeah. And it's because he worked in a steel mill when my mom got pregnant with me, and he was, you know, working in a cloud of asbestos dust. This is a terrible thing. And you're right. Stockholders in a corporation, the officers of the corporation, there's a reason why they're called limited liability corporations, LLC, right? Limited liability.
Yes.
Your liability is limited to the assets of the corporation, period. So if you run up, you know, some huge liability, some huge expense, like you kill thousands of people or you create a toxic waste site that's going to kill tens of thousands of people over tens of generations, that you're you know, as long as the corporation goes bankrupt, that's all you got. You know, your maximum liability is what you paid for your stock. Carl, excellent point. Thank you very much for calling and making it. I got the smartest listeners on earth, I'll tell you. It's such an honor and so much fun to do this show. 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Once again, the walkout sweeping across New York today. Fast food workers saying no.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
No to crummy wages, no to no benefits. We'd like at least, they say, $15 an hour. I think that's just a raw starting. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very miracaciously ugly, the good. Senator Dianne Feinstein. Now, Senator Feinstein commissioned a report that was released by the Government Accountability Office recently, which said that the U.S. has more than enough prison space to house the 166 prisoners who are currently held at Guantanamo Bay. Or, in other words, it's time to close Gitmo. After the report was released, Feinstein said, "This report demonstrates that if the political will exists, we could finally close Guantanamo without imperiling our national security." Let's hope more lawmakers join forces with Senator Feinstein and force the closure of Gitmo once and for all. The bad. Senator Mike Lee. On Mike Huckabee's radio show yesterday, Lee argued that raising taxes on the wealthy elite in America would inevitably hurt the poor in our country. Referring to raising taxes on the rich, Lee said, "We worry about the consequences that will inevitably result from that action and that will hit the poorest among us the hardest." The argument that raising taxes on the wealthy would hurt the poor has become a popular talking point among conservatives, but it's nonsense. It's just another way they're trying to keep their wallets full and avoid doing their fair share to help America's economy grow. And the very, very ugly, Sean Hannity. If you call out Fox so-called news enough, like we do on this program, you better be prepared for them to fire back at you, even with a real dud. Last night, Hannity featured a rant I did on this radio program in his liberal hate speech segment. Check this out.
For those of us that now realize Barack Obama owns the economy, owns the deficit, he owns everything, and as things get worse, you can blame him for his failed policies. But if they're going to go back, in this case, Tom Hartman is going to blame Ronald Reagan, well, there's never any hope of not blaming George Bush. Listen to this.
Black Friday, in reality, is a symptom of the plight that 30 years of Reaganomics has brought to working people in America. Right along with the frenzied rise of shoppers willing to fight each other in retail outlets across America, we've been steadily, for the last 30 years, watching the destruction of organized labor, of labor unions. We have Black Friday today because the wealthy elite have strangled their workers for 32 years, ever since Ronald Reagan's election.
Forget those 8 years of Clinton and 4 years of Obama. They didn't count. It's Reagan's fault that Black Friday people are killing themselves at Victoria's Secret.
All right. Well, first, Sean, if you're going to attack me and use a portion of my program in the process, at least get the date right. That rant was from November 26th, not the 27th. But more importantly, do you really think that the decline of the middle class in America is a laughing matter? Do you really think that millions of Americans struggling to survive as they live paycheck to paycheck is a joke? If you do, well, that's just very, very ugly.
That's incredibly ugly.
Okay. I don't get it. Let's see. It's somehow when Glenn Beck went after me, he would spell my name wrong. When Sean Hannity goes after me, he puts the date wrong. It's like maybe I should call him Sean Fannity, right? I'm guessing that Fox is not that incompetent that this is like their idea of an insult. But I find it rather humorous. John in Monroe, Washington. Hey, John, you say that taxation, the reason for, speaking of taxes, the reason for taxes is not just to raise money.
Well, no, you mentioned wealth, according to Adam Smith, and in The Wealth of Nations, you've mentioned that book.
Frequently.
Wealth is increased by productivity.
Yes.
Manufacturing.
In large part,
not
yes.
by, and he made the point, not by hoarding.
Yes.
So the way to do that, according to him, who I believe is one of the godfathers of conservatism, is to have a highly progressive taxation system where the wealthy are subject to a high tax, but don't necessarily have to pay it. You give them all the loopholes and write-offs they need to invest in their business, such as hiring, research and development, marketing, capital investment, and savings. And what this does is it keeps the circulation of the currency in the economy and makes the nation wealthy.
Yeah, the point that you're making is that there are really two purposes for taxation. And this, you know, the first guy to lay this out really explicitly, a first American politician, was Alexander Hamilton, and his report on manufacturers to the George Washington administration in 1791. And the two purposes of taxation, one, obviously to raise revenue, but two, and more important, is to change behavior. So, you know, what you tax, you will get less of. What you subsidize, you will get more of. And so, you know, tax code should be done in a way that gives us what, you know, gives us what we want. There was a time in the United States when we wanted people to have more children. So we give a child, you know, tax deduction. The mortgage interest or the mortgage industry wanted people to buy houses and take out mortgages. And it used to be people saved until they could afford to buy a house, lived with mom and dad or whatever, you know. And so then we got the mortgage deduction. Actually, credit card companies, banks, it used to be that you could deduct all interest. Reagan did away with that. But it used to be that you could deduct your credit card interest. You could deduct your car loan interest. You know, everything. That was all to help out the banks. So historically, we have incentivized behaviors that we want, and you disincentivize behaviors you don't want by using the tax code. And we need to rationally go through the tax code and say, you know, which of these behaviors do we want and which don't we want? And this was the essence of, and John, thank you for calling and making that point, because it's an important point. This was the essence of the legislation that Nancy Pelosi got out of the House of Representatives. It was passed by the House of Representatives and into the Senate in 2009, yeah, first year of the Obama administration. And it, basically what it said was, we're no longer going to give a tax break to companies like Bain Capital and Sensata that take apart factories in the United States and ship them overseas. We're no longer going to give them a tax break to do that, because that's incentivizing that behavior. But we are going to give a tax break to a company that has a factory overseas and wants to take on the cost of bringing that factory back home. We will give them a tax break for that. And right now there isn't one, because it would be the foreign subsidiary that's doing that. And so it's like flipping current law on its head, current law that has led to the loss of, in the last 10 years, 50,000 factories. And it's just common sense. It's just common sense. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, you earlier had the thing about sentient machines becoming a possibility.
Yeah.
I'd like to present another premise. We are always worried about machines becoming human. I think we have made a mistake that the problem is we're being absorbed by the machines. Right now, we stare at them all day. We put them in our ears. You see people walking along, texting all the time, staring at machines rather than, you know, being out in the world. Mm-hmm. We've turned over our memories to them, our thought process.
Yeah.
Find people even scared to figure out directions now. They use GPSs all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We have become part of the machines.
That's interesting. Yeah, our neurology has certainly changed. I remember Ned Halliwell making the point back a decade and a half ago when we were, you know, doing the circuit talking to groups about ADHD and or AD, what it was called ADD back then,
that our society is becoming progressively more and more favorable to a short attention span. It's becoming more and more ADD-ogenic because our media is becoming that way. If you look at older TV shows, older movies, older radio programs, or the old storytelling that used to be done before all of that, or the, you know, I'm halfway through Don Quixote, the original, and Miguel Cervantes, is that how you say his name? I've read it.
Close. But, I forgot to.
Yeah, and it's actually a remarkable read, but it's taking a long time to read. It's a marvelous book, you know, and an incredible character, you know, as he's going off charging on his donkey. But Boyd, it was writing different. I mean, now this is the 15th century, I think. But I'm with you, Jeff.
A very, very interesting point that was made recently. Someone is doing a study of why people text rather than make phone calls. Mm-hmm. They asked a young girl, and she goes, well, making phone calls too personal.
Yeah. Well, and
my girlfriend doesn't talk on the phone because it's not personal enough.
Right.
And so there's a dramatic change in generations that way.
Yeah, it is. And you know, at a certain level, it's nice to have that kind of layer to be able to, you know, I will text somebody, you know, Ron, our business manager, you know, I'll text him on the weekend and say, do you have a few minutes to talk? And then he'll text me back saying, yeah, how about in 20 minutes? And then we call on that. You know, that works well. That's less intrusive than the phone suddenly ringing while you're, you know, in the middle of a conversation or trying to use the bathroom or something. So I think that there's a place for that. But I also think that, you know, I'm with you, Jeff, that we have lost our connection. Our kids don't play in nature anymore. We don't go outdoors anymore.
And if you don't use your brain, you lose the function. So the thing is, it's just like you get fat if you don't exercise. Well, the same thing with the brain. And I do see that its cognitive ability does seem to be diminishing.
Yeah, in some ways. Now, the thing that we're seeing increase, actually, is with this explosion of autism spectrum disorders, is rational thought, but not so much emotional thought. And I'm scratching my head on that one. I don't know what to make of it. It seems to me, though, that we're seeing some sort of almost an evolutionary change in the human species. One of the 10 most forwarded articles in the New York Times today is about the gift of autism. And I just find it fascinating. I don't have any answers to this. And I'm not even sure what I think about it, but I'm watching it fascinated. Jeff, thank you very much for the call. It's always offer insightful and thoughtful perspectives. It's much appreciated. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And don't forget to check out freepress.net about how you can contact the FCC and say no to Rupert Murdoch.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Well, the NDAA, this is a good time to call up your local senator and say, I stand with Rand Paul. I never thought I'd say that on the air. It's time to say, let's close Guantanamo. And although he wasn't specifically going off on that, what he was going off on was the indefinite detention. Time to stop the indefinite detention. Dianne Feinstein is saying time to close Guantanamo. So stand with both of them as this legislation is being debated this week and next. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, give me a minute if you can. I want to explain something to you, and I want to get your input from it. Let me tell you how they can afford the professional sports gangster owners, in my opinion, how they can afford to pay a $100 million contract to a baseball player.
Okay.
Okay, the stadium in St. Pete, you know, it's a neocon stadium. The neocons run St. Pete, and the neocon money changers run Tampa.
Okay,
the two Chamber of Commerce's are getting together, and that stadium, there's another 20 years left on the existing stadium lease. But people don't go there because they never stop and think about the disposable income's been destroyed, like you said, with that little pit squeak Sean Hannity trying to criticize you. He doesn't know because he's a high-paid elitist. He doesn't know what it's like to live out here without health care and a living wage and no security economically. He's a punk.
Well, let's not call people names.
Anyway, they want to build a new $500 million stadium. So you say, gee, where are they going to get the money? They got the two chambers together. They're going to try to sell it to the public. They're going to say, well, it's a community thing. It's really good for the community thing. When the existing stadium, the lease isn't up for 15 or 20 years yet, and we paid for that, the taxpayers, just like we did for the Buccaneers. We paid for their stadium. You know what? It's a sham. It's an absolute sham. And they're saying it's a three-legged approach to get the $500 million.
Yeah.
It's going to be an...
This is how George W. Bush made his first couple million bucks. You know?
Well, they kept that out of the liberal media when that little punk was running for office. I never heard a thing on CNN or all the liberal media about that little piece
of crap. You heard me talking about it, Armin.
You, but I'm not talking... The mainstream's not liberal.
Yeah, well, I'm with you. No, the mainstream is corporate media. You're absolutely right. Armin, thank you for the call. Well, point well made. Paul at South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Congratulations on being attacked by that arrogant...
Let's not go there. Reaganomics. You want to talk about Reaganomics?
Yeah, well, I got a suggestion for you. I've been thinking about it for a couple months. Instead of calling it Reaganomics... call it what it really is, a Republiconomics. Republicans put the con in economics.
That's a good one. Yeah, conomics even. A good one. Thank you, Paul. Kevin in Pittsboro, North Carolina. Kevin, you want to talk about Warren Buffett?
Yes. I'm sure you saw his tax advice. Just wondered if you'd heard any take-ups on his advice.
I'm familiar with his suggestion that there be basically a minimum 30% income tax on anybody who earns over $1 million. And I hope I have that right. And that Joe Scarborough has a piece in Politico today actually endorsing that, of all things. And also saying, you know, raise the capital gains tax. Because people like Joe Scarborough, even though he makes millions of dollars a year, he takes that as salary. And so he's paying 36% income tax. It's going to go up to 39%. And he knows that Mitt Romney and Paris Hilton are never going to pay more than 15%. So... I'm with Warren Buffett on it, and I think most rational economists, you know, the Paul Krugman, thoughtful economists, Richard Wolff's of the world would say this makes perfect sense. It just absolutely makes perfect sense. Kevin, thank you for the call. James in Reno, Nevada. Hey, James, what's up?
Oh, good afternoon, Tom. I listen to you all the time, and I really, really love your show.
Thank you. You wanted to talk about Medicare.
Here's my question about Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it a crime against humanity to say Medicare is not free?
Well, Medicare is not free. People pay for it.
Well, they pay for it during their working years, right?
Right, and then I believe when you qualify for Medicare, you continue to pay a premium for it, do you not? I mean, I'm not old enough to get Medicare, so I don't know. I haven't been through the personal experience myself.
Part A, the hospital,
right,
is mostly free, but not entirely free.
Right.
Part B is not free, Part C is not free, and Part D is not free.
Right.
You have to pay to the federal government to get B, C, and D.
Right.
And then, on top of that, you have to go out and get a health care add-on so that you're fully covered.
Right. And these are all because over the last...
What is the matter with this picture?
Well, what's happened is, you know, from the time that Lyndon Johnson put this together in the 60s until today, Republicans have drilled 1,000 little holes in Medicare. And so, you know, this is why Stephen J. Hemsley and before him Dollar Bill McGuire both could take more than $1 billion out of United Healthcare, because United Healthcare is the nation's largest provider of that fill-in-the-hole insurance for Medicare.
Is that from AARP?
Yeah. AARP is their front group, basically. AARP, basically is an insurance sales company. And the insurance that they sell is United Healthcare's insurance. And that's, everything else is just window dressing.
Tom?
Yeah.
I have never, I'm pretty old. I have never heard anybody, any politician or anybody, on the news or anything, pronosticate or whatever you call them, say, hey, Medicare is not free.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, they haven't gotten the what you're going to pay for Medicare for part the rest of Part A, B, C, and D, and all of A, B, C, and D. They haven't got the...
James, I'm sorry, but we are flat out of time. The machine is crunching us here. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. It means it's brunch with Bernie, American Senator. Senator Bernie Sanders will find out what he thinks about the fiscal cliff. Ah, yeah, I think you already know. But it's going to be interesting. It's going to be fireworks. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.